Very warm welcome to St. Peter's Barge, London's only floating church. I'm Marcus Nodder, I'm the senior minister here. Special welcome if you're here for the first time. Last year we launched a new feature called One Thing in Common, where we invite different sorts of people from different walks of life, and we interview them, we hear a bit about their story, and the one thing that they've got in common, which is their faith in Jesus Christ. So we're going to have an interview, and then after that there'll be a talk for 15 minutes. We'll round things off by 1:45. And the talk today is going to be on what is the exchange rate for life. And our guest today knows plenty about exchange rates, so he's got a career in the city spanning over 30 years in investment banking. So Gresham, Professor of Commerce in the City of London, former Vice Chairman at UBS and Chairman at Lazard International, and now heads up a consulting business providing strategic advice to international clients. So would you please welcome Ken Costa. Ken, thank you very much for making time to be with us today.
Thank you very much. No, it's great to be here.
Could we start with, you are a Christian banker.
Yep.
Do you see any contradiction between those two things? Any conflict there?
Well, you're normally supposed to give me a warm-up question. No, I mean, you've got to treat me lightly. And sort of
what are your hobbies? Right, okay.
Banking. Well, you know, it's the obvious question. Honestly, from my point of view, is I don't know how you can be a banker without being have a faith, and the reason for that is that it's the sheer complexity of life, the difficulty of maintaining an equilibrium of living. I mean, I don't have to tell anybody in this room about stress, and you don't have to tell me anything about stress. I think we understand it's a stressful world. And so therefore you've got to build into the system something which actually kind of enables you to be able to do that which you hopefully good at doing, otherwise you shouldn't be doing it, but do it with the settled sort of peace in your heart.
But the idea of that's on a personal level, the idea of banking, being in finance, but being a Christian, do you think ethically there's any contradiction there?
Well, it's not a brothel. Yes, okay. Yeah, look, I mean, the point about it is we're called to be salt and light in everything that is legal by the law of the land. And so, yeah, you know, people who work for British Aerospace, you know, they've got ethical issues they've got to face with. Medical people have got ethical issues they've got to face with. You work for Glaxo, you've got, you know, research issues. You know, and we've got one or two little things going on at the moment, sort of get the public worked up, and we've got to deal with them.
Do you want to say anything about that? Because you know you head up the St. Paul's Initiative. Can you just tell us what that is and why you think it's an important thing to be involved in?
Well, as you probably know, the Occupy movement, which started, funny enough, it started in New York, just outside the Stock Exchange there. They thought they'd be there for 3 days, and they founded a worldwide movement of about sort of in 1,500 cities. And the reason for that is that I think that this group of people, and they were a weird bunch of collection of people, you know, it was like a Sainsbury's trolley filled with every kind of cause that you like, you know, from anti-capitalism to, you know, be kind to animals and environment and everything, all sort of thrown into this basket. But what they did have was they struck a chord, which was they highlighted an issue of the disconnect, in my view, between the ethical decisions that are made and actually the operations of business. So the Bishop of London said, look, we've got to get onto the front foot. We've got to forget, you know, that there is a momentary sort of issue, but we had to deal with that. And there is a broader question of reconnecting the ethics and finance. And so he created London Connection, of which I've become chairman, in order to take forward, you know, how we can argue, how we can act to draw ethics and the business that we do together in a much more coherent way. So that's what's being done. The other bit was to engage with them and actually see everything move on peacefully, which happened last week.
And would you see that disconnect as being the root cause of the current financial crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, when you strip through, I mean, I can give you any number of reasons you want of why, you know, sort of supervision, credit, leverage, I mean, you know, any technical reason as to what went wrong. At the end of the day, I think there was a fundamental disconnect of dividing and atomizing the human being into something that was called the financial person. And the markets wanted to deal with, or bankers, or people wanted to employ, financial people who would be very good at quants, very good at analysis, who would just do the financial stuff, come in on a Monday morning, just get going, and then they could mess around at home at the weekend if they wanted to. The disconnect between that and the failure to realize that human beings are profoundly financial. Of course, we're interested in finance, but we're also spiritual and ethical beings. And the disconnect between those three, those three-legged stool, meant that in the end, you know, we'd forgotten the spiritual, certainly weren't paying attention to the ethical, and the stool was now perfectly poised on one leg, and it just couldn't last. And that's what we need to do, is to bring back the unity.
You mentioned the Sainsbury's trolley of protesters. You were actually in the trolley in years past yourself, weren't you? So you were a protester, and just tell us a bit about that.
Mark, it's a bit worrying. I mean, how much more research have you been doing? You tell me more about my dark days. I grew up in South Africa in the dark days. I mean, it was awful. I didn't like talking about it much. We did just have a passion for justice. The church had sold out. It became part of the ruling establishment. I became a Marxist because I saw in Marx as being the only way out of this horrible, horrible system. I went to university there. All my friends were then locked up. And I came to university here. But it is amazing in life, isn't it? I was just reflecting on it. It is amazing, and any of you have watched the Steve Jobs Stanford address interview. If you haven't, just hit the website. It is an incredible piece. And what he said that in his life, you can only see the dots connected when you look backwards. Looking forward, the dots don't connect. And you know, who would have thought that 40 years later, all the stuff that I'd learned then was really relevant in trying to help people in the Occupy movement understand, you know, what it's like not to be appreciated, what it's like to have your views disregarded, what it's like to live in the cold, what it's like to stay in a tent, all of which I'd done.
And how did you get from Marxist to Christian? What was your story of how you became a Christian?
That was quite a leap. I was at university here, and I met an amazing group of people, and they were all called Nicky. And one of them runs HTB Church, where of course we've been together with Nicky Lee, who is the other guy. One's called Gumbel, one's called Lee. And they, you know, there was a time there where there was a university mission. I'd been brought up in a sort of nominally Christian home, and there was something, you know, a switch just turned, that there were these guys who seemed to have some kind of purpose in their lives. And although I'd had a great time, loved the university, it was just everything was fantastic, there was a deep sort of longing for more. And I couldn't find anything that really satisfied it until I realized that actually Jesus Christ did something that Marx could never do, which is he could bring a freedom to an individual rather than a freedom from some economic slavery or whatever you want to call it.
And what difference did that make in your life when you started following Christ?
Well, the first bit was a sort of coming to terms with a change of the way you view the world. And so I thought to myself, these are enthusiastic guys, be careful. Any number of muddle-headed people wander around. And I then realized that what I needed to do was to spend a year studying theology. Not such a good thing to have done at the time, but I didn't know much more because the theology faculty at the university at the time sort of was spending most of its time disputing the existence of God. And as I had just discovered God, it was not what I wanted to hear. But it was good because actually what it did was it said there is a good, credible basis for the faith that we have. It's not some kind of moony stuff, which was the rage at the time. And that, from that moment on, or from then on, I just realized that, you know, living for another, living for Jesus Christ, was true and made sense. So and it was a transforming experience. I remember it well. You know, I've tried to carry on, you know, some haltingly, some better days than other days, from that time on.
And in terms of the difference that has made in your career and your working life, if we just explore some of that with you. So, yeah. I mean, work-life balance is a huge issue for most people. I presume, as head of Lazard, you had to struggle with those sort of issues. How as a Christian, did you work that out, a right work-life balance?
It's an absolute nonsense when people talk about work-life balance, because the whole idea is, I've got work, oh, this is a terrible sort of horrible thing here, and then I've got life, wow, this is the weekend, it's football, it's, you know, it's partying, it's clubs, it's fun, you know, I've got to keep the drudgery with the delights and try and sort of mix the two together. Actually, it's not true. In Christ Jesus, all things hold together, is what Paul writes. Now, it's either true that he makes sense of everything, you know, or we're wasting our time and we shouldn't be doing it. But it is true, just for the avoidance of doubt. and it seems to me that when you have a view that Christ inhabits every aspect of your life, you know, Jesus Christ is Lord of the money markets, and he's Lord of mercy, he's Lord of profit, he's Lord of prayer, he's Lord of compassion, he's Lord of commerce. He's the Lord of all. You know, he's not, you know, this is my Sunday God, this is my Monday person. When you get that view, the balance issue actually takes itself into a very different perspective. Because then you can at least see that that Christ inhabits all aspects of your life, and then begin to navigate how the total experience of God fits into the total experience of your life, your wife, your family, your gym, people around you, communities, etc.
It's really helpful. I mean, do you ever find that one aspect of your life, though, could take up too much time, like work could mean that you're not able to give enough time to your family or to church commitments?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But you know what? None of us want to be operated on by a doctor that hasn't had any experience. And to be a junior doctor means you just got to do the hours. So it's tough. You know, but that's what you need to do. A barrister preparing for a major trial will work through the days and through the nights. And I found the same working in a complicated takeover. But the issue you have to always say to yourself is, you can't make the sort of judgment of balance, assuming you understand the first principle of it. You can't make it every week. The question is, what is the trend line doing? The trend line is that, you know, just excessive work, no family, no church, or other activities, then you'd need to take a corrective action and review yourself, let's say after a sort of 3-month period, and try and see how to correct the balances. But what you do not, I don't know anybody that lives this perfectly aligned, moment-to-moment balanced life. It's not real. Yeah.
There's been a lot in the media about bonuses.
Really?
And presumably in your time you've seen a few yourself. You don't have to go into details, but...
Oh, no, I'd love to.
How do you keep yourself from the love of money as a Christian?
That's tough. I mean, people all tell the same story. But it's tough. I mean, you know, we like... Money gives you liberty, gives you freedom, gives you choice. These are serious things, you know. So I always say to people, you know, don't dismiss. I mean, I have seen the power of money, like all of you in this room. I mean, you know, we know it's real. I can feel it. I can smell it. You know, I've sat in jets with billionaires who are as greedy as, you know, the grave. I've sat in jets with billionaires who are generous. You know, money does strange things. It's just strange. But we're all affected by it. And you'd be an absolute fool to think that you're not. So you've got to put in place some serious measures to check yourself. And the following, I would say, you need to get the perspective of what you're doing. And I think the regular reading of the Bible is just crucial. If you don't get a picture of God, you've lost. You need to pray. Not an awful lot. I mean, everybody tells you how to pray for hours and hours, but not an awful lot. But you do need to pray regularly. And I know you cheat during the week, but you've got to make it up at the weekend. I do. So that you get a sort of balance of the perspective. And then you just have to be disciplined about giving away to others, giving money away, investing in church, obviously, investing in other people in order to break the idol, which will get a grip on all of us. It's impossible to work in the city and not be constant. You're talking about money all the time. It's very difficult not to, fall from time to time.
And in terms of sharing your faith with others in the workplace, there seems to be a growing climate of fear about speaking out about our faith in Christ in the workplace, fear of losing job. Have you been open in the workplace about your faith and proactive in speaking to other people about it?
Not in the early days, I regret to say. I should have been, I know. But it's tough. I mean, I really want to be thought to be a freak. But actually, after a while, you kind of recognize people's needs. Like, they're needy. We all needy. And I suppose the two things about it. One is to, I remember in the midst of a really complicated takeover battle, I was with a guy very, very stressed, and I took him. I just said to him, "Pete, what are you doing? Let's go for a walk." We walked over London Bridge. We walked back. I didn't think, I certainly didn't say a single thing about God to him on that, or anything. He's never forgotten that, and slowly edged towards something that he saw. Why is it that you can handle the stress better than I am? I said, "Well, look around." So, it's not easy.
I mean, why can you as a Christian handle the stress better, would you say?
Well, I think firstly, this is not the only show in town. The show is going to come to an end. It's not going to be like Phantom of the Opera, just keep running with a mouse, just run and run. It's going to end sometime. And so we do look at it from a perspective of another place. There is going to be a time of judgment, yes, but also the great moment when Jesus reunites the creation. And so if you see, first you have to see that and believe that. If you're only living, if we're having a faith for the moment because it makes it more tolerable to live rather than not to live, it gives you something to hang on to, it's not going to work. I think the second thing is that it makes a big difference if you are in a group of people who can understand where you're at, who you can pray with, talk to, be accountable to, cheer each other up, go to events together and be reminded. But I do want to say one thing. The tide is turning. The tide is seriously turning, and it is up to us to take it in its flood. And if we don't, it'll be our responsibility for the next generation. It was always more difficult to talk about openly about faith and these matters. Now it is at the front of the agenda. I mean, the Prime Minister before Christmas, the Queen in the Christmas message. The moment that somebody's, the newspapers are campaigning for the first time, for Christians, crosses in a crematorium that a local council wants to take down, prayers before council meetings. These are now right in the moment, in the debating bit. This is a moment for us to talk about God, how good He is, His amazing things He's given us.
What would you say to a young Christian who was just beginning their career in this city? Any advice you would give them as a Christian? To a young Christian just beginning?
I think, you start out on the most exciting journey of life. You won't have the answers, and you're going to get trouble. You're going to get trouble every which way you look. But actually, You know that you're on a path that leads to, you know, in a fullness of life, a real ability to enjoy the work that you're doing, even when it's dull. I mean, the expectation is that work is always going to be interesting. It isn't. It's encouraging from time to time, but it isn't always that. So it would be to persevere. But to make sure as you start that you're grounded very, very well. There is a God at Work, a little book that I read on the subject, trying to answer some of these questions. There's a God at Work issue. He is there, He is with you. And figure out with other people how it is that you can live a life that is both fulfilling, doing good to other people, but also doing well yourself. And to be unashamed about doing well. And being generous.
I think I heard you say once before that you should begin as you mean to go on. So the attitude is sort of keep my head down, and then a few years' time I'll say, hey, I'm a Christian. Not the right way to go. You got any?
No, I think the earliest you live a consistent life, and are recognised by your colleagues to live a consistent life, the better. It is much, much better for people to, and it's a very much more tolerant environment, you know. That's the problem at the moment, it's very tolerant. But it's much better to be able to say, look, this is who I am, and by the way, I'm pretty good at what I do, which is always the most compelling piece.
We could go on with lots more questions. We want to give Ken time to speak to us, so
no,
I'm going to stick a little, you're happy there? I'll stick a little lectern up here and hand over to him.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be. It's great to be with you. As I mentioned earlier, I had written this book called God at Work, when I was at the last place that I was working at, a young analyst was told that he had to come see the chairman, and. So he was puzzling about it, and he thought, turned to the next analyst next to him and said to him, the chairman wants to see me, what do I do? He said, well, I don't know, but why don't you just Google the guy and see whether there's anything on Google? So he Googles Ken Costa, and up comes God at Work. to which he replies, flip, the guy's arrogant. If I could find the right bits of paper. Marcus, I haven't left a little note there, have I? Never mind, I wing it. Done it before. So let us have a look at... I want to just read a short verse or two. It comes from Mark's Gospel, and it's Jesus speaking. And he calls the disciples together, and he says to them, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. Mark 8, verse 34. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. Whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? So that's a real challenging question. These choices we have to make all the time. You might have seen in the newspaper Mika Ertegun, the widow of Ahmed Ertegun of Atlantic Records, who did Led Zeppelin and all those other things, gave £23 million. As a set of scholarships to endow people to come to Oxford University. I mean, wrong university, but nonetheless. When asked, this question by the, usual bunch of people wanting to sort of denigrate anything that looks good or generous, she replied, should I buy diamonds instead? So all the way through life, we're making comparative values. We're trading. she gave to something that would give life to a whole generation of people, or she could have bought diamonds. And she's a billionaire, has a lot of money. So we make these trading judgments. What am I going to invest my time, my energy, my money? And this paragraph, these verses that we're reading is an extraordinary thing. Because what he says is, to gain the whole world, so this is the trade, to gain the whole world, not a Ferrari, not a house in a nice suburb, not a nice house away in a country place, not a big bank balance, the whole world, that's the trade. What would it profit you to gain the whole world, all of it, and yet lose yourself, your spirit, your soul, lose yourself in this trade? Bad trade. But does it make any sense? Well, what is the nature of this trade? And I remember having a conversation with the chairman of a FTSE company at lunch one day, and he said to me, Ken, he said, look, I'm trying to assess the way my values would work. He said, I've got a box which I mark success, and he was very successful. He was chairman of two FTSE companies, made a lot of money. He said, I think I tick that box. It's good, make money. I said, yeah, it's true. He said, I've got another box which is marked friendship, and in that box I've looked around and, you know, on the way to making it, I've disregarded a lot of my friends who were at school with me, in the army, and I'm repairing those relationships. I'm building those friendships back again. I feel comfortable about it. So there's another box, which is marked relationships. I've been divorced, but you know what? I've spent a lot of time working on both families, and I really want them to kind of understand that I'm generous, I'm kind, I want to build personal relationships with these people. And he then said to me, he said, but Ken, there is another box, and I don't know what to call it. But if I knew what was in that box, I think I'd trade all the other three. And let's call it, for ease of argument, spirituality. Do you know anything about it? Oh, I said, one or two things. And it always struck me as being a very, very extraordinary perceptive person. Because he was understanding that there are, in all our lives, there are terms of trade that we have to take on. And what he saw was that actually in that spirituality box, there was something beyond his own ability, beyond his own control, beyond his own do-good efforts, which were great, fantastic things to have done, what he's done. But he realized that actually he would have missed it. Even if all those other boxes got completely filled, he would have missed out on the thing that really, really mattered in life. And we talked a bit about it, and again, I thought to myself of these verses, because all these words that are used here of, you know, what would it profit a man? What would it, if you gained the whole world, if you lost? All these are commercial words: profit, loss, exchange, gain, trade. All of these are words that we understand, the commercial world. We do this every day of our lives. And I think that one has to therefore remember that what Jesus is actually saying here is it's all or nothing. It literally is. He's saying, what does it mean if you've got everything that you really, really, really wanted to have, all of it, you wouldn't have gained a thing. You can't take it with you. It's the simplest answer to it. You know, Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher, said, the problem for philosophy is not that when I die, I rot. It's maybe I don't. You know, it's the uncertainty of it. So Jesus says it's all or nothing. And I remember in my own life, in university, I just looked about and I thought to myself, I'll do a deal with God. I've heard all these enthusiastic guys and go to prayer meetings and things. Okay, God, I think what we'll do a sort of little joint venture on the side. You know, you have a bit of the equity, I'll have the rest. kind of God said no. I said, well, what kind of God are you? And then I remember just struggling through that, saying, okay, well, we have a joint partnership, you know, sort of 50-50. And kind of didn't work. And I said, well, what do you want? And I had this sort of sense, okay, and every person who's a commercial world knows there's the hugest difference. There's only 1% different, but there's the hugest difference between 50 and 51% of a company or whatever. I remember just saying, 51%. He can have control of my life. And I remember being totally, completely dissatisfied. That just didn't work. Until I realized that it was an all or nothing trade. You know, to reserve parts, and of course, the arrogance of it, when I look back on it, I was a university student at the time, but the arrogance of it, you know, trying to barter with God, I sort of ashamed about now. But actually what it did show me was that it couldn't have been the better thing ever to have done. Because he is the one that knows our lives, made us, created us for a purpose. You know, we want to live a purposeful life. That's why you're here. You can work in a not-for-profit organization. You cannot work in a not-for-purpose organization. And most of our institutions became that. They just became money machines, had no purpose to what they were doing. So that sense of God saying, in a sort of troubling moment for me then, a struggle, which was then resolved. I said, okay, Lord, if you want all, you can have all. And I don't think I've ever regretted. Of course, I've had many doubts since then. But I've never regretted the fact that the trade is made on the other side with someone who knows all about you. It's all or nothing. And one tries to think, but is that a bad trade, a good trade? The other thing that he says is that it's everything for nothing. So let me try and illustrate it this way. I have in my hand $100 trillion note, the Bank of Zimbabwe. They were the true inventors, by the way, of quantitative easing. So here's $100 trillion, okay? Worthless, then and now. Now imagine that someone comes and says to you, okay, I'll take that off you for $10 million, US. You'd say, you're a nut. Or you're the most generous person on earth. It is one or the other. Or you simply didn't understand the difference between Zim dollars and US dollars, which is happened. But what happens is, if they saw that happening, and someone actually did an exchange, and took all those Zim dollars, dropped them off, and gave you all the US dollars, it would have been an amazing exchange. And that, of course, is the rate of exchange that we're talking about. The rate of exchange cost Jesus a life on the cross. So at the cross, he did the royal exchange, which is a building we have in the City of London, which is why it appeals to us. And that royal exchange said, you know, I will take your screwed up life, and in exchange, I'll give you a straightened up life. Basically, the theologians got all sorts of other things that happened, but basically that's what happened. It was a trade. But it wasn't a monetary trade. But what it was he took that which was worthless. Which is, you know, we can't contribute to our own getting there. It was all or nothing, but it was also everything, all the riches that God had, all the way which he made us, for no contribution, for nothing. So we gave him everything for nothing. We make no contribution to it. He did it all. So the center of the Christian faith is and will always be the cross. It just is. Because at that moment, God made sense of the world in which you and I live and of our lives. And he said, yeah, sure, I understand that you're leaving a life that's unworthy. I understand that you've screwed up your life. I understand you've messed up your relationship. I understand you've been cheating. I understand that you're greedy. I understand that. I've been there. No. I came to earth in order to get a picture of what it's like to live as a human being. And if you think that sort of moral conditions have changed in 2,500 years, then you haven't read a single newspaper. They haven't. They're the same issues that were faced then as the issues that are faced now. And so that is the trade that we make, is we take the stuff that he said, look, all the scum, all the screwed up nature of our lives. The other side of it, which we often forget, was of course this is real spendable money. These are real dollars. You can actually spend them anywhere in the world if you want to do it. You can buy things with it. You couldn't do anything with your Zim dollars. You can with your real dollars. You can actually spend it. You can get advantage for it. You can exchange it. You can pledge it. You can do everything else you want to do with it. So there becomes something really positive. It's liberating. It's knowing that you've got choice. You have things you can do. And that I find this the most compelling thing. And therefore, you know, every day I get up in the morning. I say in my book that the opening line is that I've read the Financial Times and the Bible almost every day of my life. I don't say in which order they're read. But every day, we pray. Why do we pray? To remind ourselves that there is a dependence on a God who cares, and who cares for us in our workplace. I find no problem in understanding that God loves me, loves the world, loves everybody in Africa and all over else. What I find really difficult is that God loves me in the workplace when I'm doing my work. When he sees me at my grittiest, that's the amazing truth. That's when he comes, takes the screwed up stuff and straightens it out and says, you know what, I'm going to give you a life you cannot imagine how amazing it would be. That's the trade. That's the trade. And he comes back by saying, you know, what is it if you gain the whole world yet forfeit your soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? Answer, nothing. You cannot, there is no way you can exchange something for a soul, which is itself life. But of course, that's what God did in his great plan for us. He said, I'm going to give you an amazing life. It is extraordinary. The Christian life lived to the full is an amazing life. It is a life worth living. It is a life worth spending time getting to know the person who gave it to us. So that, at the essence of it, what is the rate of exchange? The rate of exchange is that it cost Jesus Christ his life, and it gave us life in all its fullness. It's an all or nothing trade, and it's everything for nothing. We contribute nothing of our own. I don't know whether you've come here on your own because you're a regular, or whether this is new for you and you're visiting for the first time. But I would encourage you to, we don't often get times in our busy lives when we've got moments just to be quiet for half an hour. I'd encourage you, if you're here for the first time, any questions that you have, you know, talk to somebody who you see around, or you know, or came with you, or to Marcus or someone else, but don't let the moment go of really grasping. This is the most amazing exchange of taking that which was dead, our lives, a dead end, and giving us a continuing journey through life, through death, and beyond. And that's the great claim of the Christian faith.
Ken, thank you very much. Just to say, our time is gone. Just remains for me to say thank you for coming, and a very big thank you on behalf of everyone to Ken Costa for being with us today.